Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining. If we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peake, here with my co-host John Wells. Well, it's summer, it's hot, we are thirsty, so let's talk about beer. Well, let's keep it, you know, kind of sciencey. How about the science of beer making? We will speak in the first half with biomolecular archaeologist, how's that for a title, Dr. Patrick McGovern. He'll talk about his new book called Ancient Brews, Rediscovered and Recreated. How did our ancestors brew libations? We'll find out in the first half.
Good morning, Lynn. And then, have you seen the new electric buses cruising around Park City for the last few weeks? They're beautiful. Well, they haven't been taking passengers because they are in training. But tomorrow at Kimball Junction Transit Center, the official unveiling and celebration of the six new electric buses will take place. It's a community celebration at 11 a.m. Joining us to talk about this new bus technology is the Director of Business Development for Proterra, the company who has designed and built those six buses that will create the electric express route in Park City beginning tomorrow.
This is Cool Science Radio. We'll be back in just a moment.
This is Courtney Johansson with the Spur Bar and Grill, and we are proud to support KPCW. With our new 352 Main Street entrance, the Spur now features three bars serving breakfast, lunch, dinner, drinks, and dancing. Open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to 1 a.m. with live music every night. More information at thespurbarandgrill.com.
This is Tom Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We are committed to serving Park City and are proud supporters of KPCW. More information at bhhsutah.com or one of our 24 offices throughout Summit and Wasatch counties.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake, here with John Wells. John, did you ever hear these wise words from the American poet John Ciardi? He said, "Fermentation and civilization are inseparable."
A wise man.
Well, our next guest, Dr. Pat McGovern, aligns himself with those words in his new book. It's called Ancient Brews, Rediscovered and Recreated. It's part archaeological dig, part culinary science lab, part history lesson with booze. You know, there's a lot of science to discuss in beer making, both ancient and modern. Dr. Pat, as he's affectionately called, not only traces the rich history of humans' centuries-long passion for fermented drinks, but he also reveals how research science and the culinary arts combine to bring these paleo brews back to life. He joins us now by phone. Dr. Pat, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
I'm pleased to be with you.
So tell us, Dr. Pat, when did we first start fermenting liquid?
Well, I think right from the beginning. As soon as the humans came on the scene, they were capable of making a fermented beverage. And it could, you know, go beyond beer, which is technically making a brew from a carbohydrate, you know, like a root or a grain. You have to convert the carbohydrate, obviously, into sugar to ferment it over to alcohol. But then there's also the highest concentration of sugar in nature is in honey, and if you dilute honey down, it has its own yeast in it that will ferment it to mead. And then very high sugar fruits, if you get the juice out of them, they will naturally ferment as well. So it's a very easy process, and they would have seen other animals like fruit flies, even elephants, engaging in some eating or drinking of fermented fruit.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I just think it's a very easy, and we're all set up, you know, genetically and socially to want to have a drink.
Yeah, exactly. So it's interesting that fruit flies and elephants also are sort of set up genetically to want to have a fermented beverage. You know, is this prevalent throughout the animal kingdom?
Yes. I mean, I think it just about every animal is attracted to sugar and alcohol because fermentation was probably the first energy system on the planet. So when life began, it may have been, you know, the primary energy system of single-celled organisms. You could have had like a fermented beverage almost spinning around the planet at some stage. So we were kind of immersed in it. And, you know, it's integral to the universe itself. I mean, the star-forming areas near the center of galaxies have huge clouds, billions of liters of alcohol, including ethanol. So it's part and parcel, I think, of life on Earth. And then, we have very similar genes, say, for inebriation that other animals have. So they go by very fanciful names like barfly, amnesiac, happy hour, and so forth. But they're very similar between, say, the fruit fly and humans.
Patrick, about 2,700 years ago, 700 BC approximately, King Midas got married. He threw a party for his wedding reception, and they drank a lot of beer. And somehow you were able to reconstruct that beer recipe from samplings or from scrapings that you got off the vessels from that big party. Can you tell us, how do you reconstruct ancient fermented beverages?
It was actually more like an Irish wake, because it wasn't his marriage, it was his funeral.
Oh, okay.
And so we should get that straight right off the bat. So they had a funerary feast for King Midas, or his father Gordius, we're not sure. There's no sign that says, you know, here lies Midas, but it's a royal tomb loaded up with the largest Iron Age drinking set ever found, with residues of the beverage that was served at the funerary feast in these vessels. Now, the Penn excavators in 1957 excavated the tomb, which was like a hermetically sealed log-encased tomb at the center of a mound at the site of Gordian. I mean, we've all heard of cutting the Gordian knot, and Alexander becoming the ruler of all of Asia. But they were able to dig back, go through the logs, and then uncover a single male who's about 60 to 65 years old, died in good health, with this very large drinking set. And they had the foresight to bring back the samples of the residues to the Penn Museum in Philadelphia. And they sat there without having the right chemical instrumentation available for, you know, the next 35, 40 years, until we came along and, you know, really just blasted it with every technique we could dream up, like liquid chromatography, gas chromatography, mass spectrometry, and so forth. And we're able to reconstruct the whole funerary feast, which is the first time this has ever been done. So we're able to say what the beverage is, but also what the entree that went with it, which was the barbecued, spicy lamb or goat and lentil stew, very rich, high in proteins and vitamins and so forth. And then, of course, the beverage itself was not just a beer. It was made from barley, you know, which would make it partly beer. It was made from honey, which would make it partly mead. And it was made from grape, so it would be a wine. So it was a very strange combination of ingredients when we discovered this back in 2000. And we were, you know, just sort of shocked. You know, we said, you know, can that taste good?
Well, not only do you talk about it, but you also have the recipes of these old brews. So you have all the ingredients. You have, like, starting gravity, final gravity for people that are used to the home brewing process. And then you have the specific process, a 15-point process. And then, of course, as you said, the food pairings for that. I'm curious, I wanted to ask you, do you use saliva in this particular one, or was that another brew? Was that the Dino brew?
That was an earlier one, where we think humans would have first started out making beer by chewing and then spitting out, because this is still practiced today in Latin America with chicha, made from corn. It's also done with rice in East Asia still today, in marriage ceremonies and so forth. But what the idea is that we have an enzyme in our saliva that breaks down carbohydrates into sugar. And then once you spit it out, the sugar attracts insects that carry yeast that then will start the fermentation. And this is quite a common practice, you know, all through Latin America and even today, although it's done sort of covertly, because, you know, some people would think that it might be unhygienic. But, you know, if you have alcohol there, I mean, this is the great advantage of an alcoholic beverage, is it kills off the harmful bacteria. So people that drank fermented beverages in antiquity would have lived longer, you know, probably had less disease, maybe reproduced more, had a happier life, of course, with a mind-altering effect. And it really is the universal medicine of antiquity. It also dissolves herbs that might have medicinal effects, too.
It's such an efficient process, really, but I'm sure we figured out how to synthesize that enzymatic process so we don't have to chew stuff
right.
and make it happen.
Right. Well, if you sprout any grain,
yeah.
it will produce what are called amylases, which are very similar to what's in our saliva that will break down the carbohydrates into sugar. So the malting process really is very similar.
Right, right. So tell me where the oldest brewery is in the world and how long it's been there.
Okay, well, we don't know for sure, of course.
Yeah. lots of people lay claim to that, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, the earliest pictorial depiction of brewmaking is from Egypt around 2450 BC in the tomb of Ti. He was one of the close confidants of the pharaoh and was also the head hairdresser, and a bunch of other titles went with it. But he had a special tomb that was built for him at Saqqara, you know, one of the sites close to Cairo. And in that, besides showing, lots of scenes of, how to make food and drink in the afterlife, there was also a scene of beer making, which showed it's very closely coupled with bread making. Because, the two, are using similar ingredients, and bread was actually used in the beer-making process. So we see, a whole series of scenes that was a way to replicate how to make beer in the afterlife. So at first, Egyptians, they would just put jars of actual beer or wine into their tombs. Later, they got smarter, you could say, and they started just doing a pictorial depiction and then having a, something in hieroglyphics that might say, thousands and thousands of jars of beer.
Yeah, nice. I believe it was in my mid-20s sometime I found myself in a brewery, or a brew pub, I should say, in, I think it was Prague. And I think they claimed that it was the oldest brew pub. I don't want to call it a brew pub. I think I have the wrong word there. But, it all has to do, going back to why monks are such big brewers. Yeah.
Maybe it was still operating, the longest operating.
Right, right.
Yeah. Well, there's, of course, Czech Republic and Pilsner Urquell are very delicious. And, it used to be my favorite beer, because the hops and the water and everything go together so well there. But I just recently came back from Germany, where I made a visit to a lot of the medieval breweries in Bavaria and Franken. And so these go back to about 1,000, which are earlier than, I think, anything in the Czech Republic. But they, and we have projects, we're doing with scientists at some of the beer schools over there, like in Munich, there's something called Weinstephan. And so we're going to be looking at possible remains of a fermented beverage. It could be a wheat beer or grape wine in very fantastic sites in eastern Turkey. When they were putting in the dams for the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, they had salvage projects for archaeology, and they discovered these monumental buildings dated back to 9500 BC, right after the Ice Age, which have very realistic depictions of all kinds of animals on them, very strange-looking humans with snakes curling down their backs, just amazing structures, which they don't know the purpose of, but there are large vats close to them, and we have residues now that we're going to start analyzing that might shed some light on what the motivations or how a fermented beverage might have been involved in what is thought to be cultic buildings. And so we know that einkorn wheat was domesticated very close by, also some of the other founder plants of the Neolithic, like bitter vetch. So it makes sense that these people may have been really experimenting and, settling down for the first time, and fermented beverages could well have been one of the incentives for doing that, because you have to be in a fixed place to be able to take care of your crop and then process it into a fermented beverage.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Dr. Patrick McGovern. He's the scientific director of the Biomolecular Archaeology Project for cuisine, fermented beverages, and health at the University of Pennsylvania Museum in Philadelphia, where he's also an adjunct professor of anthropology. His book is called Ancient Brews, Rediscovered and Recreated.
Dr. McGovern, tell us about the 15th and 16th century Bavarian law that was put together.
Oh, okay. So that is the purity law, the Reinheitsgebot, in which you could only use water, barley, and hops, of course, and then eventually yeast. So they really narrowed the confines of what the ingredients could be, for probably different reasons, but, you know, that's a whole separate question. But what it did is sort of restrict, you know, what brewers then could use as ingredients. And we know that before that time, they were using all kinds of herbs, like yarrow, bog myrtle, meadowsweet. You know, just the list just goes on and on, because a lot of them had medicinal value as well. So it kind of cramped the style, I would say. And by doing these, rediscovering these ancient brews, we have like opened up a sort of Pandora's, you know, a positive Pandora's box of all the other possibilities. And we see how very innovative our ancestors really were when it came to making fermented beverages, especially, you know, because they didn't have synthetic medicines. And so they would want to use other herbs, not just hops, and, you know, which might have, you know, really positive effects on their well-being.
Yeah, exactly. Tell us about the Dino brew from the Cretaceous period.
Oh, okay. So this is sort of an imaginary reconstruction that I sort of call it the holy grail of ancient fermented beverages, because we know that in the Cretaceous period, say 150 to 60 million years ago, we had really the first time that all the ingredients or animals, plants, and so forth came together to be able to make a whole lot of fermented beverages. We have the first fruiting plants and trees, which are fertilized. Then, the animals, like the fruit fly or the bee, emerge for the first time, and they're able to pollinate the fruiting, flowering trees. So that it, you know, it's advantageous for them to have a really delicious product, which can be fermented. And so you also have, you know, even the dinosaurs who, flying dinosaurs in particular, which have come down to be our birds, are very readily attracted to fermenting fruit. So, you may have seen, you know, in your neighborhood, you know, some drunken robins, you know, crashing into windows. I mean, that happens fairly frequently. So and the yeast, of course, the Saccharomyces cerevisiae, you know, reaches its final form, in which it has doubled up its genome so that it's able to process alcohol or sugar into alcohol to such a high percentage, say above 6 or 7, 8%, so it kills off all the competition. And then once the bad microorganisms are gone, then it can switch that enzymatic system back so that the alcohol can be taken and used to make energy.
Okay. Dogfish Head Ale House, they still make ancient brews, don't they?
Right. The one that we make every month is Midas Touch, and we talked about that before. Mm-hmm. So it's the best-selling honey-based beverage in the United States at the moment. And it is also one of the most tasting awards of any of the other Dogfish brews, which, you know, has become very popular in the last 17 years since we've been doing this ancient program. So it's got many gold awards, which is quite appropriate, you know, the touch of gold, but also many silvers and bronzes and so forth. So it's way ahead of all the other Dogfish brews and in the tasting category, and it's really a very special, delicious beverage.
Now, I'm not even an amateur brewer or anything like that. And so when you talk about, you know, beer with hops, honey, it creates mead. That part confuses me, because in this Dogfish brew, the Midas Touch one, we have honey. So is it a mead? Is it a beer? What is it?
Yeah, we call it an extreme beverage or hybrid beverage or grog or cocktail. Great. You know, it's just an assembly of different ingredients that have enough sugar to produce, you know, probably higher alcohol, which has always been the goal of humans. And also, you know, give special flavors and aromas from the different ingredients as well.
Yeah. Wonderful. Well, you've said a few things that have stuck with me, that fermented beverages are integral to the universe. I like that one. And I'm going to remember that the next time I'm sitting on my back porch and crack a bottle
of
wonderful.
Yeah, the Milky Way.
Yeah, exactly. And you also talked about the remains of a fermented beverage, which I think is so funny because we talk about the remains of a dinosaur, human skeletal remains that have been uncovered, but your remains are of a fermented beverage, which is just so great. But
of course, we want to try to recreate it if we can. And, you know, that's the whole goal. Like a dino brew, for instance,
right.
You know, we can kind of imagine what the different ingredients might have been in Cretaceous Africa. So you might have different kinds of fig or date trees, you know, that start dropping their fruit. And there's resin oozing out of the tree that gets combined with it that has antioxidant properties that help to preserve it. And then along comes your dinosaur and laps it up and or knocks the tree a little bit more to knock down more fruit. And then you have other animals, all the insects gathering and, you know, really enjoying, you know, what could be called a dino brew.
Right. So great. I just wanted to ask you about, well, it has to do with the drunken monkey and your exploration of that topic. And I think what it is we as humans tend, and across the animal kingdom, we like the something that in high doses can be toxic and a poison. You know, and that self-regulation and that issue we have with that. And can you talk about that with regard to the drunken monkey?
Right. I mean, so humans seem to be able, you know, we're omnivores, but we also, you know, take in like small amounts of what could be considered bitter or toxic compounds that have other, you know, effects. You know, that could be, you know, antibacterial or have some, you know, effect on our system, but not in large quantities. So alcohol is the same way. It's not really a toxic compound. The really toxic compound is acetaldehyde, which is converted into alcohol. So like the some Asian people, they don't have the enzyme that converts acetaldehyde into alcohol, so they get what's called the flushing reaction, which, you know, shows that acetaldehyde is a poison. But alcohol itself is not a poison, but if you take it in large amounts, you know, can have very serious effects on cells and, you know, kill off liver cells and that sort of thing, or even brain cells. But in moderation, it actually has been shown now medically to, you know, be very positive, and that's because of that phenomenon of, you know, being able to imbibe or consume a certain amount of a bitter or, you know, what might otherwise be a poisonous compound.
Right. Well, the book is called Ancient Brews, Rediscovered and Recreated. And I'm wondering, Dr. Pat, who your audience is. I mean, is this targeted for home brewers or is it just for anyone who's interested in the history of beer?
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to have the original title be more general, just have it more like liquid time capsules, because it really then would encompass all the different fermented beverages. And in fact, we get into distilled beverages in the last chapter, too. So to me, it's a general view on how alcoholic beverage have played a role in human life, you know, right from the beginning, all over the world, and trying to see how it's implicated with, you know, the rise of civilization, with the rise of language, arts, music. Music is very important, and, you know, people that tend to have an alcoholic beverage, you know, may engage in dance and so forth. And really, the earliest inscriptions we have from the Mediterranean world have to do with the arts and wine or beer. So it's something for everybody, I think. You know, the hard scientist, we had a nice review in Science magazine, but also the person that enjoys a fermented beverage, We give music suggestions and clothing suggestions to go with your drinking of the beverage. So it's a, I think, a very overarching perspective that I try to give, and which hopefully, you know, that's the message. You know, so it goes out to everybody, really.
Patrick, you all hit a home run with Midas Touch. What are you working on now, and how close do you try to get to what you think is the actual beverage versus trying to make something which is commercially successful today?
Well, that is the point of the book, is to show, you know, how much goes into trying to rediscover these, you know, all the archaeology, archaeobotany, DNA studies, and so forth. You know, but that is just a very small percentage of the available evidence, and a lot of the organic remains are destroyed, and we have to then go from, you know, this very minuscule database and then try to figure out what the processes might have been, what the yeast and other microorganisms might have been. And, you know, it's not 100% by any means, and there's lots of possibilities. So what we're doing is playing with the variables that we have, trying to see what we can come up with. Of course, the assumption is that the sensory organs of humans have been pretty constant, you know, from the beginning up until now. So, you know, if we like something, you know, that's a good measure of whether our ancestors would have liked it as well, you know, although there's cultural and individual differences. But it's really trying to, you know, travel, like we call it, you know, back to the future. You know, we're finding out, you know, just how innovative and, you know, what our ancestors really knew all along. And we just have to rediscover that and then bring it back to life the best we can.
Yeah, I was thinking about that regulation on beer with barley, hops, and water, and I was remembering this wonderful beer I had a few weeks ago, Camp Wanamango from Harpoon Brewery, I think, in Boston, with mango in it. You know, that wouldn't have bode well back in the days of regulating with three ingredients.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can just take three ingredients and come up with something very nice. Now,
yeah.
Midas Touch is got saffron as the bittering agent rather than hops. But those plants, you know, it's the female part of each plant that really produces, you know, that aromatic substance, you know, which draws us in.
Yeah. Wow. It's good stuff. Well, the book, again, Ancient Brews, Rediscovered and Recreated. Our guest from the University of Pennsylvania Museum is Patrick McGovern. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
And it's Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back to talk about electric buses when we return.
Hi, this is Beth Lohman from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. The Epic School Kids program gives all children across the state of Utah from kindergarten through fifth grade 5 days of skiing plus 1 day rental and lesson. More information at parkcitymountain.com.
Earl Foote here, CEO and Chief Technology Consultant with Nexus IT, still supporting the station and staff of KPCW. Technology can be slow, old, or frustrating. Nexus IT provides service, sales, and maintenance for your personal and business computer needs. 435-487-9099 or nexusitc.net.
Beth here, owner of Peak Art and Frame, longtime supporters of KPCW. At Peak Art and Frame, we carry a wide variety of framing options, and our design staff can help with any project for your home, office, or gallery. Open Monday through Saturday and located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801 or peakartandframe.com.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells, and I'm here with Lynn Ware Peak. Starting tomorrow at 11 a.m., Park City Summit County will unveil 6 electric buses that will make up the Electric Express route between Kimball Junction and the Park City Transit Center. They've been designed, built, and marketed by a company called Proterra, with offices in Salt Lake City and in Silicon Valley. The CEO, Ryan Popple, came from Tesla to develop electric technology for the masses. He and his wife also live in Park City, and joining us now in the studio to talk about new buses and the technology behind them is the Director of Business Development for Proterra, Alan Westensko. Welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you.
Tomorrow's the big day.
It is. We're excited. And just to clarify, Ryan Popple and his wife's parents live in Park City.
Ah.
This is his favorite place to visit, and yes. I bet he lives here someday, just to be clear.
Oh, well, it'd be nice to have him here. So he has an interest in having these buses here.
He does. He won't say it, so I probably shouldn't say it on the radio, but I know this is his favorite deployment we've done to date. So, and you know, it's a perfect match for everything that Park City stands for. So we're really excited.
Yeah. So the last time we spoke to you, which was about a year ago, the grants had not been approved, and now they have, and the county has stepped up as well. And all of this is really unveiling the way everyone was hoping it would.
Yep, that's right. Yeah, Park City was awarded funds from the FTA. It's called the Low and No Emissions Grant. They received that last August. And then they put in such a good application with so much detail, we were able to turn around and get buses built to their specifications very quickly and get them deployed, as you mentioned, tomorrow.
Yeah, very exciting.
So last year when we talked to you, I think that you had about 67 buses deployed, as you call it, across the country. What are your numbers now? Or maybe they had just been ordered and not yet deployed.
Yeah, we had about that many deployed. These buses will be numbers, the sixth bus will be 109 buses. So for Park City, I think that's our 16th city to be using the buses. What's happened, the market has really just popped open.
Right.
Park City is still on the front end of that, but we've got several hundred orders that we are working to fill they'll be coming because people are understanding and accepting that this technology is here to stay, and that Proterra really believes that in the next decade or so that you likely will not see diesel buses on the road anymore because this technology makes so much sense from an economic and from an environmental perspective.
Right. So let's talk about the relative miles per gallon when it transfers over. Of course, in an electric bus, there's no gallon. There is no fuel. It's zero emissions. But when you figure everything in, the electricity needed to charge it and all of the, maybe you could even call it carbon footprint, how does it all figure out, if you can explain that?
Yeah, good question. So we believe that the application of electric vehicle technology has the highest value and highest impact on a mass transit bus. And here's the reason why, if you think about it. There's several reasons. One, as you mentioned, the federal testing for our bus shows that we have an equivalent miles per gallon of 22 miles per gallon. And that's just measured by British thermal units when you look at the heat that it takes to run that, compared to, say, 4 or 5 miles per gallon on a diesel bus or a CNG bus for that matter. So you're 4 or 5 times more efficient. And then because you don't have an internal combustion engine, your maintenance is significantly less expensive, maybe 50% less expensive on average. And so what ends up happening, you end up saving maybe $35,000 to $40,000 a year on your maintenance alone if you're driving the average 35 to 40,000 miles a year that a bus drives. And so the next reason this makes so much sense is the heavy utilization of buses. A bus drives 3 to 4 times as many miles a year as a passenger vehicle. So the more miles you drive, the more savings you get. It also works because you've got a really big vehicle, so you can put lots of batteries on. And if you look at the way a bus operates, it's lots of starting and stopping. You've got a high torque motor, electric motor that's built for that. And you have regenerative braking. So when you stop, you're actually generating up to 30% of the energy again and recapturing that. So all of those pieces make a lot of sense. And then as you see on the Park City route, it is a defined route. It just goes back and forth all day long. So we don't get range anxiety. We know where the charger is. We know exactly how many miles we're going to run. We know when the bus is going to get charged. So we never worry about that. All those reasons. And then, of course, the one that I haven't even mentioned that may be the most important is that buses operate in urban settings. And when you have an electric bus, it's quiet and there's no tailpipe. So there's no emissions, no local emissions.
If you're just joining us, we're having a conversation with Alan Westensko. He's the Director of Business Development for Proterra. And you're going to see his buses moving around tomorrow, a direct route between Kimball Junction and the Transit Center here in Park City. That starts tomorrow with a celebration at 11 a.m. Now, in addition to that, the composite weighs less than metal, so we've got a weight advantage. And also, I think traditionally with diesel, as I recall from our earlier conversation a year ago, the cost of ownership was calculated over a 12-year period because there's 30% less moving parts and it's much more efficient. you feel that the vehicles will be on the road for a longer period of time. And because of that, if you amortize over 15 years, the savings even gets better.
Yeah, that's right. We one of the innovations that Proterra did, we're the only company that I'm aware of anywhere that builds a mass transit bus from the ground up. It's purpose-built. It was designed to be an electric bus. If you try to put an internal combustion engine on, it'd be a disaster. But it works really well. We've designed it so the batteries all go on the bottom where you want batteries. It makes it so that it drives really, with the weight center really low to the ground, it drives well. But it also allows us to put more energy on the bus. With it being lighter, it's significantly lighter with a carbon fiber reinforced composite structure. And so we're able to get take the weight off of the body and maybe and allow it to put more batteries on. Other companies who build these buses, they take a metal bus and they try to retrofit it to put batteries and electric drivetrain. And we just find that if you're going to do it, you have to do it right. And to get the range and make the durability, you want to be able to build it from the ground up.
These batteries are going to be sitting between the wheel wells at the bottom part, but pretty far away from the passengers. Will there be savings or gains in maneuverability in the snow because that weight is between the axles versus a diesel bus that has all the weight behind the back axle?
That's a good question. We actually, you may have seen there was a Proterra bus during the Sundance Film Festival. We brought it up for Park City to just get used to it and let people know what was coming. And the comment from the transit folks who operated that bus was that it was the best bus they'd ever run in the snow for exactly the reason you said. The center of gravity is a lot lower to the ground, and so it just plows through. In fact, we joke that you ought to put some snow plows on the front of those buses and just get them double duty.
That's good. And we know there was a lot of snow during Sundance this year. We all remember that. Let's talk about battery technology. So even since we spoke to you about a year ago, I think the proliferation of, say, Nissan, Leafs, and Teslas in this town has been huge, and people are becoming more and more familiar with it. So let's talk about lithium-ion batteries, because it's my understanding that these are the batteries that allow the high torque, is it, or the immediate power transfer. And talk about lithium to begin with.
Sure. So lithium-ion is the battery technology that has developed. It's what you see in most of the electric vehicles, and it's what allows us to have the high-density storage in a single place, and then it allows to be able to deploy that energy very quickly and very well so that you're able to get a constant source of power. But the most significant two things. One, we're able to put it together in a way that's first and foremost safe. And that's the most important thing, especially on a moving vehicle. We want it to be safe. But secondly, we want to be able to give enough energy density so that you have range. You can travel a long distance without having to charge the bus all the time or worry about that.
Okay, so this is more about the lithium-ion portion of it, because I know there are batteries developed with other compounds. Is that right?
Sure.
Yeah.
And a lot of times you'll see a lot of batteries will be lithium ion, right. Say, for example, on the anode or the cathode, and then you'll have a different chemistry on the other side. So lithium ion is a big name for the type of chemistry on one side, but then you'll have, for example, these buses are using what's called lithium titanate oxide, and it's a chemistry that has been developed. The batteries on this particular bus were initially developed by Toshiba, and they are a less dense energy, but they allow the bus to charge very quickly. So when you go to Kimball Junction and you see the charger, it's a really heavy charger. It's putting 350 kilowatts of power in and charging really fast. But that chemistry on the buses in Park City allows it to top off in 5 to 10 minutes. So that's the way this route works, so that they actually could run this 24/7 if they wanted to and make sure there's always enough energy. So there's less energy density with that chemistry. We've actually come up with a new chemistry. So we have two offerings for different applications. So if Park City wanted to run buses, for example, in other parts of the community, and they just wanted to plug them in overnight, they weren't running this route that's really heavy utilization back and forth from Kimball Junction. We have another battery chemistry that allows us to put up to 440 kilowatt hours of storage, which ends up giving us over 200 miles of energy range, of range on a bus with a single charge. So it depends on the application. Mm-hmm. This is the perfect application for the LTO chemistry on the battery, where you want to just be able to charge it and keep it topped off all the time. Other applications use this other technology we've developed.
So the topped off technology, I believe you had a test recently. Was it Seattle?
Yeah, that's right.
So it was a duty cycle of 24 hours, and it was 365 days, and it never had to be plugged in because it would go, and correct me if I'm wrong, into the either overhead or down below charging station, and it would get topped off and keep going.
That's right. So you'll see there's an overhead charger at Kimball Junction, and it was the same bus, same technology in Seattle. They wanted to run it. They actually ran it for 3 months straight, 24/7, to demonstrate a full year of normal use. So it was like 34,000 miles, which is a normal year of use. And you're right. So those buses are designed so that if you wanted to, you could run that bus all day and all night and never have to pull it off and charge it. So like you said, it's a different application. And it was an innovation that Proterra figured out about 6 or 7 years ago to say, hey, listen, with where the battery technology existed then, we figured, hey, this works really well on a bus because it goes in a circle. We know where the route is, and it allows us to be able to get a charge every time we stop and let people on and off for, say, 5 minutes or so, which is how these buses will work.
Okay. And the actual charging apparatus, there's no direct connection. There's a space of air in between them, slight like a toothbrush.
Actually, these do have that would be an inductive charge. These have a conductive charge, which is actually more efficient, but it's up in the air, so it's away from the public. It's on top of the bus, and it's actually automated. So if you see it, the bus will pull in, and what will happen is the charger, it's actually a level one autonomy vehicle. It actually, the bus and the charger communicate, and the charger will, the bus will lock in, and the charger will actually find where it needs to go and charge automatically. Once it's topped off, it'll pull off, and then the bus can go away.
Now, if the batteries are improved technologically, will we be able to upgrade to the new technology?
Yeah, of course. The batteries are built so that the buses are built so you can go back and forth. If Park City decided that they wanted these buses to run on a different type of route, where they didn't want to have the ability to do the top off of fast charging throughout the day and night, we could just replace those batteries and integrate a different technology on. So the way to think about the bus is the platform. And as other technology continues to develop, you can continue to add that technology on for many, many years to come.
Wow. Last year when we spoke with you, I think we also talked about some trucks, some big commercial use semi-trucks that were using your technology. Was that right?
Well, I would say that so we don't use any our technology right now is only used on mass transit buses because it's, like I said, it's really the best application. Mm-hmm. That being said, because we are building our own batteries now, and we've hired, I think it's arguably the best heavy-duty battery engineering team really anywhere in the world. We're building these heavy-duty batteries in Burlingame, California. And it's a pretty cool sight to see these batteries being built. And the application, the thing that's exciting is that while the best application right now is on an electric a bus, it could also be transferred to any other heavy-duty application, like a truck or a train or a boat, or anything you can think of that right now maybe uses diesel fuel that would benefit from using a heavy-duty battery application.
Yeah, okay. So let's talk about the environmental impacts of retiring a battery. I know that you will take the battery out of these buses after they've been used up just 20%. You repurpose them, you use them where, and then what happens at 0%?
Yeah, good question. So we do take the batteries off, typically 70 to 80% of what we call the state of health. So once only, like you said, 20 to 30% of the energy has been used, once the battery degrades to that level, we pull it off. It still works, but we want to make sure that the bus has enough energy to continue to meet its route. And so the battery itself will last for 12 years. We just want to make sure there's enough energy. So we'll take that off, and we could put it in any other number of storage or applications. Could be stationary storage, so you could put it up next, you know, to with a solar panel, for example. You could put it in as a grid management type system, where you've got spikes during the day with the grid, and you could use that to balance your load.
So I have solar panels on my house. Uh-huh. Could I feasibly purchase one of your retired batteries, hook it up, because we've all been waiting for this Tesla home battery to come out, right?
Right.
But this could do it. Okay, sign me up, Alan.
Right.
Well, that sounds pretty good. Now, the regenerative braking capabilities. You state that you have 30% of the power that can be recaptured. Can you talk about that technology?
Yeah, what happens is the way to think about driving one of these buses, it's like driving a big electric golf cart. If you've ever driven a golf cart, you really don't use the brake very much. The golf cart just kind of slows down. And it's because the engine is actually slowing that down. And the way to think about it is it has an electric motor in it, and the electric motor is turning one way when it has energy being put into it to power the vehicle. And what's really happening is the motor is just going the other direction and generating electricity from the mass of the vehicle stopping or slowing down. And so when you're doing that, you're not using the brakes so much. And this is the same technology you see on a lot of hybrid and other electric vehicles. This isn't new. It's just a good application with a transit bus, which is starting and stopping a lot.
Yeah. Lynn, these are really cool-looking buses.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah, space age. Tell me about what you're doing at your house again. You've got solar panels on top of the roof, and you want to be able to, on a sunny day, capture and store energy for later use.
Right, and then eventually I think the goal is that you're off-grid.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, one of the things that you mentioned that I didn't answer is the impact of a bus. And I think it's worth noting a couple of things. One, when you take a diesel bus off the road, just an average, kind of traveling diesel bus, you're eliminating 100,000 gallons of diesel fuel over the life of that 12-year life of that bus. So it's hard for me to even imagine what 100,000 gallons looks like, but right. These buses, when you're getting 4 miles per gallon, it's a lot of diesel fuel. And then when you are eliminating that, especially if you have a plan like Park City has, to be able to have all of its electricity coming from renewable, carbon zero sources as the city has implemented in the next few years, so that your zero emission or zero carbon going in on the generation and there's no tailpipe coming out, you would be able to, on average, reduce the CO2 emissions or the pounds of CO2 being generated by about 3 million pounds over a 12-year life, depending on the technology you're comparing that against.
Wow.
And this direct route from Kimball Junction to the Park City Transit Center, Lynn, you told me earlier that there are a couple of stops. There's Whole Foods, not Whole Foods.
Canyons.
The Canyons, and then
And Fresh Market.
At Fresh Market, okay. How often are they going to run, do you know?
I don't know what the city's final plan is. I know they're going to run them early morning to late at night to be able to provide really easy access from Park City and then in Summit County to Kimball Junction, where you've got that high population and high density. So I don't know what the city's determined. But like you mentioned, they have the ability to run these buses all day and all night if they wanted to. There's no need to bring these buses in and charge them in the depot. They have a depot charger, actually. They can charge the buses there if they need to, but they're designed so that they can actually run them as much as they need to. And in the wintertime, when you're generating more heat, then it makes it so that it's not a problem to keep them charged all the time.
Right. So the idea is, I think, with this route that it is what they're calling the first or phase one of the bus rapid transit. So it's like, it because it has so few stops and it is a direct route, they're predicting that, every 10 minutes or so, that's the length of the route. So, of course, it's traffic dependent, but these buses also, even though we don't have a dedicated bus lane, there is the ability to pull onto the shoulder and around if needed. So, and that is coming as more and more of this transit and transportation program is developed, both with the city and Summit County and regional collaboration. Asking about disposal of the batteries, what happens at the end? I have no idea.
So after the battery, we pull it off, after it's used its second life, so let's say that the first 4 to 6 years that battery gets used, and once it gets to that 70% to 80% state of health, we pull the battery off, and we would put it into a second life, like you talked about. It could be for stationary storage or any other number of applications, because it has a lot of energy storage on it still. At that point, we've designed the batteries so that the metals that are valuable that we'd want to recycle are easy to pull out. So we take those metals and pull them out and are able to recycle them and repurpose them for some other use. There's a lot of value in everything there. We can repurpose the actual casing. There's actually four components to a battery. There's the cell that usually look like the little cylinders or the pouch. And then you have the actual module where they all work together. And then you have the pack where they're encased. And then you have the energy management system all together. And we're able to divide those up as needed to be able to recycle them as appropriate.
Alan Westensko, he's the Director of Business Development for Proterra. Proterra designs and builds the buses that, well, starting tomorrow at 11 a.m., there will be a direct route as six electric buses will make up the Electric Express route between Kimball Junction and the Park City Transit Center. Thanks for joining us this morning.
It's Thank you.
Great information. And I also wanted to say, even though you're a business developer, you sort of sound like a chemist as well. Is there a background in there somewhere?
No. I just know enough to be dangerous here. So
that's good. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah. We shall return right after these messages. We've got a quick, cool story for you. Stay tuned.
Miller Orthodontics is a proud supporter of The Randy Barton Show. Since 1988, my wife and I have provided a combined 45 years of orthodontic care. For our Invisalign patients, we provide digital scanning and imaging technology that eliminates the need for wet molds of your teeth. More information is at m2ortho.com.
Spend the day and cover billions of years at the Natural History Museum of Utah. The museum offers innovative exhibits and hands-on experiences. Native voices explore the traditions of Utah's native peoples. The Great Salt Lake Gallery tells the story of the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere. The Past Worlds exhibit includes more than a dozen new species of dinosaurs discovered right here in Utah. Visit nhmu.utah.edu. The Natural History Museum of Utah is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. John Wells here with Lynn Ware Peak. A quick, cool story for you. Scientists from the University of Utah, they're responsible for monitoring the supervolcano in Wyoming, the one we've been talking about under Yellowstone, that they've just discovered a new magma cauldron that could fill with magma the Grand Canyon 11 times. Anyway, there's been a swarm, and I haven't heard that to describe an earthquake or a series of earthquakes, a swarm of 464 earthquakes that began on June 12th, the biggest being a 4.5 magnitude on June 15th. And the takeaway here is that they have approximately 1,000 to 3,000 earthquakes that occur each year, so there's no real concern that this thing's going to blow. Last one blew 500,000 or 600,000 years ago, and, well, I think we're in pretty good shape. But there is some activity out there. Lynn, what do you think?
Well, a 4.5 magnitude earthquake doesn't sound like a lot, but while the epicenter of the shock was right in Yellowstone National Park, they felt it, or it was felt, in Gardner, Montana, in West Yellowstone, and you know, kind of spreading out into the region. And this was the biggest magnitude quake since a 4.8 quake struck in March 2014. And we have had a couple seismologist guests on this show talking about this supervolcano over the years, but they don't seem concerned. So,
and we're not concerned either, but we wanted to report it because there's some stuff shaken up above us.
That's right. You're listening to KPCW Park City.
Hi, I'm Matt from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of contemporary and mountain modern home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake and offer complete design services. We are on the web at sanfrandesign.com. San Francisco Design, love your home.
I want to thank our underwriters today on Cool Science Radio, the Natural History Museum of Utah, Peak Art and Frame, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Park City Mountain, and San Francisco Design. You've been listening to KPCW Park City. It's time to head into National Public Radio News from Washington.